Hello and welcome. Historical Significance proudly presents Loving Our Longtimers speaker meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. My name is Camilla from Chicago, and I have the privilege and honor of serving as your chairperson tonight. Each week we invite speakers to share with us their personal knowledge of the origins and early history of NA, many of whom have 30 years or more clean. We are recording these historically significant speakers to better share their experience, strength, and hope with our fellowship. You can download these messages at Historical Significance website, nabyphone.com. We welcome a Seventh Tradition donation through PayPal to help support our website. Let's open our meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the third step prayer. Many of us have said, take my will and my life, guide me in my recovery, and show me how to live. This week, our guest is Craig, and Craig has gone above and beyond to join us tonight since he was just released from the hospital earlier today. But we are very grateful and thankful that he is here with us tonight to share his particular perspective on our history and our beloved fellowship. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you. Thank you, Carmela. First of all, I'm Craig and I'm a grateful recovering addict. I give all props. I'd like to thank my higher power, you know, who I choose to call God, for his grace and mercy, because if I had my way, I would have been dead in 1969, the first of many ODs. I'd like to just share my strength hoping experience and just to let our family know where I hail from. I'm from West Philadelphia. You know, I was blessed to be raised in a nuclear family that had both a mother and a father. I have an older brother, and I have a younger sister. And, you know, like many of us, I had a fairly normal childhood. In fact, it was normal up until about the age of 12, and my father opened up a nightclub in West Philadelphia that was... It became to be very successful. And, you know, so I worked with my father from the age of 12 or 13, just washing dishes and sweeping floors. And I was exposed to, I guess, in our community, it was people like Muhammad Ali that would come through there, Wilt Chamberlain. He had a sports bar. It was actually the first sports bar in Philadelphia. So, and it catered to the black community, so there was a lot of black hustlers, politicians, athletes, Johnny Sample. So, I often share that my first addiction was addiction to money and fantasy, because I saw it was like a B movie. But when I started first experimenting with chemicals, and I think I'm not unique. It was, I started drinking in high school. In fact, I remember going to my first high school dance and getting drunk. You know, when I look back on it, I see myself having some type of character defect that time in relation to women. So the alcohol sort of like gave me false courage. But that's about the only thing I did through high school. And, you know, I am a product of the 60s. Which basically I'm old. You know, I just turned 63, and I'm 63 in March, and I'm really I'm so blessed and grateful to be here. And you know, and I think part of my story will show that. But like I said, you know, I used just drank and smoked a little bit of marijuana. It wasn't until I first went away to college. I went to Morgan State College in Baltimore, Maryland. And as I said, that my father had a pretty famous nightclub in West Philly. And, you know, so I was exposed to a lot of hustlers. And when I went to Morgan State, you know, like I tried to fit in, and I ran into a group of guys from Harlem, New York, that were also at Morgan. And I liked the way that they presented themselves. You know, I thought we were fast in Philadelphia, but I think, you know, Harlem had a one-upmanship on us, so to speak. So that was in 69. And in 69, I was, you know, they said, if you want to hang with us, you got to do what we do. And, you know, so they introduced me to my drug of choice at the time. And my story is no different than any other addict's story. I love Narcotics Anonymous because it's a program of truth. And what I mean by that, you know, they tell us, you know, it's a, you know, jails, institutions, and death. And it continues to baffle a lot of people when they become a reality, you know, because I've died four times. I've OD'd four times. And I know it's only God's grace and mercy that I sit here, you know, and I give him, you know, and I had developed a pretty significant understanding and relationship with God. In fact, that's one of the things that was told to me coming into this fellowship, that I need to get a God of my understanding. And I have to say that he hasn't let me down yet, and I'm so grateful for that. But, you know, just to fast forward, you know, I was actually in an active addiction for 15 years. Everything that could happen to you as a result of the disease of addiction has happened to me. I've been shot. I've been stabbed. My first marriage, divorce, you know, my wife, in fact, I divorced my wife in 81. She divorced me in 81. And she still hasn't talked to me since then. You know, and it's unfortunate that, you know, some people, I believe everybody needs a program and should have a program, but some people just don't grasp it, so they hold on to resentments, and, you know, some people will never change. But as a result of me doing damage in that relationship, and, you know, and that was one of my motivators to get clean, was that when I was using, I just became disgusted with me. You know, and so, you know, my addiction took a pretty big toll. And what I mean by that, the first time I went in treatment was 1973. I went into a therapeutic community for 9 months, and I went in there to save my marriage, which didn't work. I separated in 81 from that. And but I went away the first time for the marriage for 9 months. And I went away again in 81 for 9 months. And that time, my job sent me there because everything else was falling apart. And finally, I went back to that same facility in 84. And, you know, I'm really glad that I thank God for utter desperation. You know, I mean, our literature talks about, you know, we can pray over us. We can have all the psychiatrists and psychiatry, but nothing has ever worked in this addict's life until I actually came into our program. And that's where the love of the program has worked for me, you know, because it gave me some understanding of my disease. You know, for years, I substituted one drug for another. I was on methadone for 10 years. I substituted and tried to smoke marijuana. You know, it's not about the drug. It was about the addiction and my relationship to that. And, you know, the narcotics gave me a very clear understanding of that. And I'm just so grateful for that. But one of the things I'm so grateful for is that when I started using drugs and exposed my drug of choice in 69, the particular drug that I used was a subculture at the time. In fact, in Philadelphia, sort of like my old heads raised me. Like, see, I just couldn't go to a street corner and buy my drug of choice. They had alleyways, and they had a subculture. And if you didn't know these people, you could not get that drug of choice because the drug of choice was illegal. And, you know, that's why even to this day they call it Narcotics Anonymous. And if you read in our literature, it tells, you know, like, we are under no surveillance today. That's there for a reason. Because in the city of Philadelphia, some of my predecessors in the dope game, in 64 and 65 in Philadelphia, they would have a squad. It was called the Anderson Squad, and it was narcs. And their whole job was to bust addicts. And they actually, if you had needle marks on your arm, they would lock you up for internal possession. And they would send you to a place. They'd put you on a train. And I never went there because they had stopped that practice when I tried to get clean in 73. But this is in the mid-60s, and I heard this from a lot of them, that they would send them to Lexington, Kentucky. And that was a federal hospital slash prison. And that was only time. That was one of the only places that treated addicts at that time. But they, you know, you got a case and you went down there. And the only reason I say that is because if you look at that literature, it tells you about. That's why our fellowship, at least in Philadelphia, did not flourish and grow because of the implication of being narcotics. And if you know anything about a narcotic, you understand that's an illegal substance. So, you know, most addicts, you know, in the 60s, and, you know, including myself, later years, we, because of our use of drugs, we had records. You know, we went to prison, we got locked up, we got on parole. And if you know anything about being on parole, you violate your parole by being with another person that's on parole. And so it was common practice in Philadelphia that we had to, like, have underground NA meetings. And that's why they didn't flourish for a long time. In fact, in Philadelphia, in the mid-60s up until, I could say, until the late 70s, there were probably five or six NA meetings. And those meetings weren't in the Afro-American community. They were in predominantly white communities, even though they didn't discriminate. They just weren't. In fact, I'm going to the oldest NA meeting in West Philadelphia, which is also the oldest black meeting in Philadelphia, on Friday night. Their anniversary is 35 years, and that's at 38th and Walnut. But we do have other meetings that are older, but that was very significant. Because that's where I'm from. But just to make a case in point, when I went away to my first treatment facility in 73, they sent me, and I went back home, which is one of the places they said, don't go back to West Philly. And I went back to West Philly because I wanted to work in my father. I thought I could work in my father's nightclub and not use. And they suggested that I go to AA. And because there was no NA in the whole West Philadelphia area. Now we have hundreds of meetings, and that came about in the mid-80s. The mid to late 80s, they started to flourish. But when you go back to 81, 82, there was very few. In fact, like I just said, 82 was where this particular meeting started, and I have a close relationship with a lot of those guys, even though I didn't get clean in Philly. I got clean in Norristown, Pennsylvania, which is 20 miles outside of Philly. And the reason I did that is because the two previous times I went to this facility and they told me not to go back to Philadelphia, and I went back and I was using in no time. So the last time I went through there, incidentally, my anniversary date is 8/18/84. God willing, on Monday, I'll have 30 years of continuous clean time, which is most significant to me. I truly believe my greatest asset as an addict is my clean time, because if I don't have that, I don't have anything. And that's just for me. That's for me, because I know once I throw my clean time away, all bets are off. And that's one of the things I grasped in our program, and that's one of the things that resonates in me today to my predecessors and what they shared when I came into the rooms. You know, just don't use under any and all circumstances. And you know, to be perfectly honest with you, that's the only thing I've done over the last 29 years, 11 months, and 20-something days that I haven't done is not used. You know, I'm not here you know, sharing with anybody that I'm a perfectly recovering addict. I'm not. I have had my trials and tribulations, and I've had my struggles. The first being, you know, cigarettes. When I got clean, I went from smoking one pack a day, and by my third year being clean, I was smoking 2.5, almost 3 packs a day. And thank God that at that time I developed a relationship with myself that I felt as though I needed to give them up. My anniversary is New Year's Eve, and I'll have 27 years clean this New Year's Eve from cigarettes. So my disease, and I'm sure I'm not different than anybody else. If you've been around here long enough, you know that our disease manifests in other areas. When I gave up the smoking, it showed itself by eating. And I'm 5'7", and my normal weight is 170. And when I gave up cigarettes, I went up to 220 pounds. And that's only because of my disease manifesting itself in that area. And I had to address that. And, you know, it's you know, then it went on to sex. You know, and I'm not, you know, I did, you know, we get, you know, when our secrets are exposed, then we can really share part of this process. And my process, I often describe myself as a slowly recovering addict because it's just something in my DNA that all my life people have told me to go to the right. But it's something about Craig that just so happens he likes to go to the left. And, you know, the only thing that I ascribe to perfectly was that I didn't use. And I heard that from my predecessors from the last time I came in. Like, yeah, it was my third time in treatment, and I was 33 years of age. I was beat up. I didn't have a pot to piss in, and I thank God for that utter desperation and for my predecessors at the time that told me I never had to feel that way again. And, you know, as a result, I haven't, you know, and that's been the beauty of this program. When I say the beauty of this program is that this is a program of truth, you know, and I think that a lot of times I know right now the fellowship has changed over the years, and I don't hear it enough when we try to give the newcomer a clear message, and the clear message that any addict, okay, can lose a desire and find a new way of life. And how that starts is by not using just for today. And so every time I speak, you know, I'm not one of those speakers that I try to live the program. I don't dress to impress, so to speak. You know, that's not, I've been blessed to get, you know, even though I think there might have been times in my recovery that I might have liked to have been on stage, what have you, but I was never a circuit speaker. I was always busy trying to improve myself and do service work. But one of the things that touches me most about our program and what I sort of like veered off the path is that when in the mid-60s, And towards the late the 60s and the early 70s, where I come from, most of the people that used drugs either died or went to the penitentiary. So I was blessed at a point in time that I did have the availability of the program. There was no program in our community at that time. Like I said, that the oldest program is at 38 from Walnut, and it's just funny that they're having their anniversary this Friday, which I'm really pleased because currently, and, you know, I was telling Carmella the first time, I believe a friend of mine sort of like recommended me to talk, you know, because what's been struggling, I am, as a result, let me, what I'm, as a result of going back to school, I went back to school, and I got a number of degrees. I'm a psychologist, and I work with the military. And, you know, when we talk about doing service work, I've done service work in our fellowship, but our literature also talks about we become protective members of society. And my job today is I'm home right now. I'm in Norristown, Pennsylvania, and I'll be home for this week. But I reside at Fort Drum, upstate New York, which is the infantry for the Army. That's where we deploy out of. That's all the soldiers that do all the fighting. That's our Rangers, and my job is to welcome them when they do. We're one of the largest forts in the United States that deploy for Afghanistan, or where, you know, we just deploy more soldiers than anybody. So my job currently is a very high security job, and I'm one of the first people that welcome our brother and sister soldiers when they come off the plane. I've been blessed to shake their hands and thank them for sacrificing their time and putting their life on the line. I've also had, I guess you could say, the opportunity to support family members who have lost loved ones and their bodies come back, and I have to talk to them. So I consider myself in service. And when Carmela first talked to me about speaking, I was in Hawaii. I had just taken, I was in Hawaii with my wife. We had our 25th anniversary. And so it was sort of like not convenient. And I told her when I go back to Fort Drum that I would speak for the group. Unfortunately, when I went back to Fort Drum, we were redeploying a lot of, just over the last 2 months, we've gotten 7,000 soldiers back from Afghanistan, and I had to be an intricate part of that. So one of the nights I was supposed to speak for you guys, our planes come in, and because of security reasons, we don't know. They come in 24/7, and thank God that 2 weeks ago, all our planes have come in, so I basically had a breather for that. But so, I mean, that's what I'm doing currently. But, you know, like there's no coincidences because one of the things that Carmela, you know, I was, as a result of me using drugs, I developed hepatitis C. And hepatitis C, in fact, in 1992 in my area, hepatitis C wasn't diagnosed. In fact, for some of your old-timers, you know that it wasn't diagnosed as hepatitis C. They called it hepatitis non-A, non-B. It wasn't until the early 1992s that that's when I was diagnosed with hepatitis C, and a lot of the peers in the fellowship. You know, if you use a particular drug, and at that time, I could say that most of the people back in the 80s, there were some crack addicts coming in, but a lot of the people in my region, they were dope fiends, you know. And so IV drugs. So I didn't even know I had hepatitis C, but to make a long story short, it affected a lot of people in our fellowship. It really did. And as a result, a lot of old-timers have been passing away, you know, as a result of that. So I've been struggling with that particular disease since 1992. I was put on the list to have a transplant in 02, and I was taken off the list in 2011 because I was responding. So because of this program, because of our program, it allowed me to respond to, you know, be very proactive. And that's one of the things I like about our program. You know, our program has, it talks about our inability. Most of our problems come from our inabilities to take personal responsibility. And that's one of the things that I've grasped onto. When I say it's a program of truth, they tell us. You know, they tell us if you want what we have and are willing. So you got to be willing. You know, you got to want. I had to want this program. And through my desire. You know, we do flame that desire in people when they come into our fellowship. At least I try to flame it. I know I can't save them, but what I can do is I can show them my experience. I can show them my experience, okay, and how I am, you know, with how I've been in this process. And hopefully if they want that, they can take suit, you know, and I'm so grateful for that, man, that to just to be of service and to try to help somebody. But I understand today that you got to want it. You know, but they have to want it. And, you know, that's part of, you know, what I do at my home group when I am home. It's unfortunate up in New York. I'm up in the mountains, and I don't know. We're 5 miles. Fort Drum is actually up in the mountains, 5 miles from Canada. And like I said, we train our rangers and our warriors up there. Over this past winter, we had 164 inches of snow, and it's very brutal. And as a result, our fellowship up there is only one. They have one meeting, one night a week, and it's about 5 or 6 people in those meetings. And I'm not trying to stereotype anybody, but they're mountain boys. And I mean, it's really it's almost like Appalachia, and if you're not from there, it's really hard. And also, let me put it like this: the most clean time they have up there is 2 or 3 years. People just go in and out. So it's been very hard for me to thank God of meetings like this. And I also we have. In Philadelphia, we have, on the Internet, we have a recovery group called The Ship, and we also have Narcotics Anonymous. I think a lot of you might be aware of that I participate in. And then, you know, I have, because of being in recovery so many years, I do have a strong support network, which, you know, I'm just forever grateful for that. And they try to keep me, whenever I come back home, like I'll go to a meet. I was going to go to a meeting tonight, but I was going to go to meetings. I'm a meeting maker. I go to meetings. In fact, it's unfortunate that I go to so many meetings that it, over the past 5 years, I'm like the oldest person in the meeting now. You know, so I find that we do have old timers meetings up here, but they don't. I go to all meetings, and you know, we do have old timers who just go to one particular meeting. And I can understand that sometimes you have newcomers in there that talk about pretty, you know, superficial stuff. And you know, when you have so much time under, you know, I think that we mature and grow to different levels. But what I find that God, how God works, and I deviated from it a little bit, is I got a call from Carmela today. And I was actually discharged from the hospital today. They diagnosed me when I came back from Hawaii in May. They diagnosed me with a liver cancer. And that's sort of like, this is something I've been dealing with. I haven't been dealing with the cancer, but I've been dealing with my liver disease. And my doctor took me off the liver transplant in 2011. And what he said, we're going to watch your liver because for cancer, because you have a history of cancer in your family. And sure enough, they gave me, I get MRIs twice a year, and over the last year, it's been showing up in my blood. And just in April when I went for my MRI, they saw the tumor. So they actually operated on it yesterday. I'm at the University of Pennsylvania, which is my wife is a research nurse there, and it's a very skilled hospital. So it was, the surgery was very high tech, you know. But what I'm saying in essence is that I'm struggling with a life-threatening disease. I asked the doctor, I said, if I don't get this treatment, how long will I live? He said 6 months to a year. He says, if you do get the treatment, it could be 2 to 4 years, and you have an opportunity to get a transplant. So I opted that. But I only share that with the group is that I got this call from Carmela today, and I was feeling sort of bad that I wanted to share my strength, hope, and experience there was other two times, but it wasn't the right time. You know, like what, you know, when our soldiers come in, I have to be there for them. That's the number one priority for my country and also my job. So, but when she called me today, it was best time. And I always know that God, you know, works anonymously. There are no coincidences. When things happen, they happen for a reason. And I just needed to share my story. You know, when I talk to people about my condition, people, the first thing they respond to me is that they're sorry. And, you know, and I'd say, you know, like, this is not a death sentence. You know, this is, for me, this is an opportunity to live my life and do what I really need to do. So I'm going to retire probably in October. And, you know, as a result of the last 30 years, financially, I shouldn't have a problem. And so I'll be able to deal with my family and my kids and, you know, just live life just for the day, you know, and I'm okay with that, you know. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about this program is that from day one when I came into our program, I heard my predecessors talk about their parents dying. And at that time, I couldn't fathom that. I just couldn't fathom that and not stay clean. I knew that if my parents died, that I would get high. But fortunately, it was 10 years being clean before my parents died. So by that time, I had developed enough hope and strength from people sharing that, that when it came time for me to step to the plate, that they had exemplified to me that we don't have to use, and I didn't use. I buried both my parents. Well, that's what I'm doing today because I've heard some of my predecessors and also my peers. This is a disease. Hepatitis is a disease. In fact, it's very hard to get a liver because it's an epidemic. And I've lost a lot of friends who had long-term clean time, a lot of friends to liver disease. And I've had friends that have had liver transplants and then couldn't get another transplant because of the hepatitis C affected their new liver. So, but what I did hear from them is that you still don't have to use. And that's where I think God has given me. That's why I tell my story the way I do is because I am on death's doorstep. But that doesn't mean I have to live in death. You know what I mean? That we can, you know, the beauty of this program is that I can pass this on to my peers because all of us, if you have long-term clean time, something's going to be coming up sooner or later, if not just the aging process. It's just going to happen. But, I mean, as a result, like with myself and the way I've neglected my body, I always knew that I would never live to 70. I did some pretty foul things to my body. I don't have a vein left in my body. I've been shot. I've been stabbed. I put all kinds of drugs in my body. I used benzodiazepines. I can't remember years of forgetting because of my relationship, because of drugs. You know, so I just knew that, you know, that I wouldn't have, I wouldn't be blessed with a normal life like most people. And that holds true. But I'm also here to say that just because we've been given, you know, just because I'm strong with a life threatening disease doesn't mean that I can't work this program and continue enjoying life just for the day. And that's what the program has really, you know, helped me to do, is living today, you know what I mean? And it's been a process, and it continues to be a process. I just try to pray to God for some willingness so that I can, and more than anything, one of the things that I find most difficult in my recovery that causes me most pain is my lack of acceptance of things. When I can accept what is, and I pray for you. I pray to God all the time. Just let me accept the reality of whatever situation may be, because there's a lot of situations that I lack of acceptance, and it causes me some emotional pain. because I can't accept where this person is at, or I can't accept what's happened here. And, you know, so that's one of my biggest things that I continue to work on, because when I finally accept the reality of it, then that's where I find my peace and gratitude and serenity. But I struggle with that. I'm human, you know. So, you know, that's what I'm currently in the midst of. You know, I talk about my finality, but, I know that God has the ultimate say here. And I also recognize that I know my purpose is not done yet. You know what I mean? I've helped a lot of people, and I continue to help a lot of people. And when he does say it's my time to go, I'm just grateful for the time he's allowed me to make amends. I don't have to go in guilt. And I'm so grateful for that. You know what I mean? I'm so grateful that he gave me the opportunity to walk my mother and my father to the grave, to be a good son. You know, it wasn't that way, man, 15 years in my recovery. And that's the blessings of this program. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I never really wanted to become a circuit speaker, so to speak, because for me, ultimately, the step process is about self-acceptance. When I can look in the mirror and I can say, job well done, and I can pat myself on the back and really be all right with Craig, for the most part. I know there's some days I deviate and I beat myself up, but for the most part, I can look in the mirror and I say, you know what? I am a good guy. I think that's one of the greatest things that this program has given me, man, is the ability for me to accept me who I am and the opportunity to be the best person I could be. And I'm just really grateful for that, you know. So I'm sort of like, you know, I hope I was able to give some history. You know, I was talking to Carmel before the meeting started that I'm sort of blessed. Norristown, Pennsylvania is 20 miles outside of Philadelphia. I went to a rehab called Eagleville Hospital. Eagleville Hospital had one of the first meetings on the East Coast. This was a hub. Like a lot of people in my area have, let me put it like this. We have a member that just died, had 45 years. We have another member, Dave F., he has 40 years. He has 10 years more than me. We have a number of other addicts who have 35, 36, 37 years. Well, that's unheard of in Philadelphia. Philadelphia, I think, you might have one or two people that have 30 in the mid 30 years. And that's only because our relationship of a guy that was from this region went out to the West Coast and he hooked up with Jimmy Kay and he brought back the white book to this particular hospital and they started meetings. And that's my home group, incidentally, is Eagleville Hospital. And those meetings, we just celebrated 39 years. So, and that's when it's not a H&I institution. It's actually open to the public, but it's at the hospital. So it is a public meeting. But the reason I just say that is because there's a lot of clean time here as a result of that relationship, you know. So I feel really blessed to have had that. But when I go to Philadelphia, I'm like, you know, it's not as abundant people in recovery there with this long-term recovery, you know. But they do have it, but it's not, you know, per capita, so to speak, of addicts. Like here, we have a large number of people that have 35, 30, 27, 29 years. And for the amount of people up here, it's very high. So I've been blessed. I've been really blessed in this process, and I feel really, you know, I feel really good that I'm on this journey, and I hope that I was able to share with the group some, you know, because what I was also taught when I came in, we need to share where we're at. We need to share where we're at just for the fact that somebody else might be dealing with something that or maybe not dealing with anything yet, but will be dealing with something down the line. And I was blessed to hear some of our predecessors who have died from liver cancer, died from hepatitis C, and they didn't use, and that was their message, you know. So I'm just so grateful, you know, to let people know that under any and all circumstances, whatever comes up in our lives, man, we have a program where we don't have to use. And I'm so blessed that I can make it to the 30-year mark. For me, that's unfathomable, because where I come from, at the time, most of us died, you know, and it's I feel very grateful for this program and how it's grown and flourished, you know, and that's why we say I was in the scholarship when we didn't have, We Do Recover. That pamphlet didn't come out until about 15 years or 20 years ago. You know, I collect a lot of memorabilia. I have an NA archive. I don't have the Red Book, but I have I would love to get the Red Book, but they want $2,500 for it. I just can't afford that right now. But I have every other edition of basic text, and I love our program. It's not, you know, I just hope that the group got something from what I shared tonight. If nothing else, when I ever share, I say I bought into the program. We only keep what we have by giving it away. So if I didn't help anybody tonight, I helped myself. Thank you a lot for allowing me to share.
Thank you so much, Craig. Thank you. And you helped me too. You helped me very much too. You know, what I got so strongly from you was that, you know, you are so grateful and your life is service to this program. Everything
yes,
you
sir.
Do is about helping others. And I'm sure that was not true before recovery. And I think that, you know, that's the most important thing is that, you know, we get better, we do better, and we help others get better.
Right.
And that's huge. Got a couple of questions we ask all of our speakers. How many meetings do you go to a week generally?
Oh, well, if I go to a meeting every day. I would go every day. Up in New York, I go to that one meeting, which I haven't gone to, so I go online every day now. That like I said, that one meeting, I went for 8 months, and it's a very small community. It's called Watertown, New York, and they have 5 people that go to the meetings regularly, and I tried to be an example, and they sort of like it's a shame, but I go to a meeting every day. Usually, I stay in touch with meetings on the ship, either by the ship or I try to. Logistically, it's just impossible. But if I'm home, I go to a meeting every day. I'm going to a meeting tomorrow. I would have went to the meeting tonight with my wife. I'm going to the anniversary on Thursday. That's one of the biggest faults. My wife said, you go to meetings too much. But she doesn't understand that. Because I'm a meeting maker, and, I go to meetings where over at least the last 5 years, I've been in this process so long that a lot of my peers don't go to meetings anymore. And I don't rag them. I'm not ragging anybody. But if you stay around here long enough, some of you will know what I'm talking about. You know, I think it's just a few of us that continue on a regular basis. I'm not talking about just going to one meeting. I know a lot of old-timers that go to one meeting a week and that's it. That's not my story. I go to a meeting almost every night.
Wow. I'm coming up on 30 years clean at a meeting every day still. That's incredible.
Yeah,
do you have a sponsor?
Yes, I do. My sponsor has 34 years. He's pretty well known in Philadelphia. His name is John Reed. Of course I have a sponsor. I couldn't do this by myself. John Reed he was my counselor at the rehab, in fact. And then I had another sponsor, and then something happened to me 5 years ago where I, you know, it was very devastating to me. My disease turned up in another area. I was a therapist, and I'm not proud to say it, but I deviated. I broke an ethical code, and I lost a $150,000 a year job. And I had to get a new sponsor, and I got him as a sponsor, and made amends. And God saw fit for me to work with soldiers. You know, I was blessed not to get any of my credentials taken away from me because it was entrapment. But I should have known better. But I'm not perfect. But I mean, God saw fit for me to work in a different population, and thank God I did have this sponsor, because at the time the fellowship judged me, and I was getting ready to turn my back on them. Because, you know, one of the things I've come to understand is that, you know, we tend to go from the from demonic to angels, you know, and there's no balance in between. And I found myself being judged by peers. And they say, you know, and we try not to judge, but I was judged, and I felt ridiculed. And I went to my sponsor, and my sponsor told me, he said, here's how it goes, Greg. The program is perfect, but you're dealing with a room full of individuals that are sick as you, and they're just trying to get better. And that put it in perspective for me, because I was getting ready to turn my, until you've been through some type of crisis in our program, and like one thing about me, I am honest, and when I do wrong, I admit it, and that's been one of the saving graces. I think that's the only way that you can get better is by being honest, you know. And when you get honest, then you really take a look at your character defects. And I, it was very painful. But I got a new sponsor at that time, because I think my old sponsor, we just became friends, as opposed to over a period of time, we stopped working the steps and we were friends. You know, he had two more years than me, but this last sponsor I have, John, he's much more spiritual, so he's helped me a lot. Because I was getting ready to turn my back. I don't know if anybody's been through a crisis in our fellowship where you have been judged, but that's a terrible feeling.
Yes. Yes, it is. We can forget our spiritual principles with each other
right.
So quickly.
Right. You know, and it's a shame. I know we try to do the right thing, but like I said, you know, even my own biggest difficulty is finding balance and understanding, you know, that nobody does. And, you know, we all sin on different levels. Let me put it like that.
Yes, indeed.
You know, so, but yet we are so quick to judge, you know what I mean? Or some people are. And it's really, you know, it's just, and once again, it went back to the acceptance piece, and that's what he was trying to teach me at the time. And I thank God I did not turn my back on the fellowship, because I know a lot of people that have. I know a lot of people walked away from the fellowship, but I have not. You know, but like I said, I'm low profile in a sense that I don't buy into the circuit speaker. I'm not dressing to impress. I've been around long enough to know a lot of the circuit speakers, you know, for whatever reason, can talk a good game, which I believe we all can talk a good game. I mean, you know, that's just our nature. But some of us can impress better than others. And then when we leave out of there, we do the exact opposite. I've been around enough to know them personally. And so I just try to walk the walk rather than just talking.
That's great. That's great. How often do you contact your sponsor?
Contact him? I talk to him about once a week. He just moved to Florida.
Okay. Okay.
We talk about once a week, but I mean, or the need arises, at least once a week, but sometimes two times a week if I'm struggling with some stuff or, you know, I really feel a need to reach out to him, I'll call him, you know?
Yes, yes. How many times have you formally worked the steps?
Taken
pen and paper and wrote out the steps?
Yep, three times.
Okay.
Three times. I'm not, I believe that, and well, that's three formal times. But there's been times when I had to work a particular step and not go through the steps, you know. I mean, I work steps as they apply in my life. And sometimes, you know, like for instance, the 12th step, I'm constantly applying that. I mean, that's a step that I just never, the 11th step, I'm constantly applying that. The 10th step is part of who I am. It's something that I don't have to necessarily go on paper. I've done them all on paper, but I'm talking about applying them. See, we can all talk the steps, but see, when you really work the steps, and this has been my experience, that's the people that are more, that you can see it in their spirit.
Yes, I agree with you.
Okay, you can feel it in their soul, you know. They don't have to talk it. Even by their smile, you can see it. And I think that's when, you know, for me, I mean, in my own, for me, it's like you being all right with who you are, and therefore there's no competition.
Yes. And that's what also came through to me very, very clearly, was that you are at peace with yourself. Your self-acceptance is very, very high, and that's something I'm working on in my life.
And that's ongoing, you know? That is ongoing. I mean, you know, like I'm in my room right now. I'm in my NA room, and I have pictures in my room. I've been to all the world conventions, okay, since 84 I started going, okay? Not 84. I started going to conventions in 94. I was in school for many a year, and I couldn't go to world conventions. My first world convention was Baltimore, Maryland, 1994. But since then, I've been to every world convention except, it was two, okay? It was, I couldn't go to Paris because I didn't have the money. I was paying myself to graduate school. I wanted to go to that, but I couldn't go. And the other one was a choice because I was obsessing about that. It's when we had it in Colombia. I started thinking about bringing back some cocaine, and my sponsor said, it's best that you not go. Because I found out that you it's not a good idea. He said you could get a brick. Now, there was talks up here that you could get a brick of cocaine for $100. So I had these illusions in my mind that if I took $1,000 with me, I could be the next Pablo Escobar.
Well, there would have been the slight problem of getting in the country, but it's probably best that you didn't go.
Exactly. You know, but there, you know, that's the only two conventions that I have not been to. You know.
Okay.
I go to world conventions. I've been to Hawaii, Barcelona, San Jose, San Diego twice, St. Louis. Yeah, I'm a meeting maker.
Okay. And I guess our last question we ask all of our speakers, how often have you hopped in a car with a bunch of other recovering addicts with a wing and a prayer and 21 cents in your pocket to drive many miles to support an NA event?
Oh, wow. When you talk about the money, money, you have to understand, is not an issue, okay? But I go to events all the time like that when I can. You know what I mean? I'm going to our area. We have a convention, not this weekend, next weekend. But whenever I have the opportunity, I always. But you know, I'm going to tell you the truth. With me working away and coming back to Philly, well, I go. let me see. With Delaware County is having their first area convention, okay, in October. It'll be their first area convention, Delaware County, which is a county outside. I'm in Montgomery County. Delaware County is also a county, also a suburb of Philadelphia. They're having their first convention in October. I've been, every when I come home and they're having like a speaker jam, I go down there, and over the last 3 months, I've been down there three times to support them, to buy T-shirts, to buy food. So I do, that's just part of who I am, you know, but it has more more or less to do with the timing more than anything. If I could do it, I would do it all the time.
Okay.
You know, okay. Yeah, but my life is pretty, you know, it's I do live the program. I mean, you know, I wish I would love, historically with me, it would be nothing for me to go to New York to the old-timers meeting up there, or I don't know if you've ever been to that. They have a nice one in Harlem. I've been to a couple of times. I always try to broaden my base. But, you know, as in my case, especially the last couple of years, you know, with my demands and my job or what have you. But, you know, Syracuse just had a convention I went to, which, you know, Fort Drum is like 100 miles from Syracuse. And Syracuse, they have a pretty nice fellowship up there, so that was good. And they just had a convention the end of May. Which so wherever there's an opportunity for me to go, I'll go. I go to Montreal, you know. I'm 2.5 hours from Montreal. I go to Montreal for meetings at least once every 4 or 5 weeks.
Wow. That's wonderful.
Uh-huh. I love the program. I really do. I try to stay connected. I think that's been one of the saving graces. But I also believe where I'm at right now, God put me up. It's called the North Country, upstate New York. It's nothing like New York City. It's like a world apart. New York is almost is a big state, sort of like Texas, okay? It's not big as Texas, but it's very big. And where I'm at, it's sort of like the Appalachia. Okay, there's a very poor, impoverished area, if you know what I'm saying. The only thing that's up there is the Fort Drum, which is where I'm at. But if you go out in the community, they're very poor people.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you can look at that type of individual and visualize them in a meeting, you have to understand that the mountain people, you got to break through. Okay, let me put it like this. That's also one of the biggest reasons. Next to Tennessee, it's called Tug Hill District. That's one of the most populated areas of inbred breeding.
Aha. Uh-huh. Kissing okay. Cousins.
Right. Right. So you're
all
gonna,
right.
Can you understand the mentality?
Yes. Yes, I can.
Yeah, so that's what we're dealing with. And for months I tried to really, you know, fellowship, but I'm not part of the family. And as a result, the meetings haven't grown. They only have one meeting up there. And the people in Syracuse, when I go down to Syracuse, they pray for me. They say, you're up there, you know, because they know the history. They know the challenges that NA has up there. There's just some places that NA can't flourish and won't flourish because the individuals can't adopt the principles.
Yes, and if you can't adopt the principles, it's very, very difficult to work a program.
Right, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, and they even recognize it in Syracuse. They say, wow, man, you know, and they give me their numbers and they reach out to me because they know what I'm dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
But I truly believe I've been up there for 2 years. I've been with the military 5 years, but basically I travel all over the world. You know, they send me, but I've opted to stay at Fort Drum to finish out my career. And, you know, like I shared with you, it's probably going to be a little sooner than later. I'm going to retire probably this year, you know, in October. But that's a good thing. But I was trying to just stay there. So, because my job, I've been to Alaska, I've been to Korea, I've been to Italy, I go to Germany. Wherever there's a military post, that's where they need us, you know. So, but those places present challenges, you know, for me. So when they offered me this position up at Fort Drum, which is only 7 hours from my house, it at least gives me opportunity every other weekend. If I want to come home, I can come home.
And that's important.
Yeah, it is, especially when you're married.
Yep. Well, all right. Let me open this board up, see if anybody in our audience would like to ask you any questions.
Okay.
Does anyone have any questions for Craig or any comments on anything he shared? We have rather a small group with us tonight. But,
okay.
Hello.
Hi.
My name is Sharon. I'm a grateful recovering addict.
Hey.
And I just want to thank you guys for having this meeting. I couldn't get out to a meeting, and I'm easy to make excuses. I don't quite have 30 days yet. I've been in and out for a while now. I am from Philadelphia, but I no longer live there. I grew up in West Philadelphia. And,
that's where I'm from, West Philly, 52nd Street.
And that's where I'm from as well, 52nd and Haverford.
Well, you know my father's bar, Mr. Silks.
Yes, I do. Yes, I'm from that exact same area, yes.
Right.
From 52nd and Haverford, yes. And
small world.
It's a very small world. I went to Girls High, graduated from Girls High, and I've been in and out the rooms for a while now, like I guess about 15 years. A friend of mine, she's my sponsor now. She's from Philadelphia as well. And she's coming up on 24 years. She put together a woman's spiritual retreat a couple weekends ago, and I flew in from Georgia to attend and help her stuff some folders and things of that nature. Not thinking that I still had a problem, and she's, you know, I'm thinking that my life is productive or whatever, and I saw a friend there who was saying, oh, you look good. I remember you had 9 days and I had 7, and I'm coming up on 15 years. And it kind of struck a nerve, and so I decided to, you know, do the right thing, and that way I wouldn't have to be lying by omission. And maybe I, too, can do some things to help other people, as I have done in the past, but taking the focus off of myself, putting it on others, not really recovering the way that I should. And hearing your story is amazing because it just, like you said, there's no coincidence that you were from Philadelphia, and just the whole story, I could relate to it. I could just visualize things as you were talking, just being from the same area. And you've given me a lot of hope. And I just want to say God bless you and your family. And you've given me a lot of hope. I can say a lot of hope.
Thanks.
And I'm going to keep trying one day at a time.
Right. And you know what? You know what? For real, I'm actually, I'm from 52nd and Westminster, which is right up the street, you know, Westminster Avenue and Haverford. Haverford is Haverford Parish and then Westminster.
Right. And I grew up right on Wilton Street, the 200 block, right off the block.
I know. Yeah, Wilton Street. I know right between 52nd and 53rd.
Correct. Yep.
Wow. But anyway, one of the things that only I can share with you is, and I think we as addicts a lot of time, you know, time is important, but I think just the miracle of having one day, right?
Yes.
And what I suggest is that you give yourself credit, man, that, you know, stop counting the days and start making the days count.
Okay.
Because I've seen so many people with time that that's all they have. Do you understand? They just have time.
I understand time. Completely, yes.
So don't discredit yourself. Don't discredit yourself. You know, just make your days count. Do what you can. Do the best you can do today. Help somebody.
Right.
And above all, you know, I mean, and above all, you know, put nobody above you but your God.
Right. Wow, this has been an amazing meeting. I've been trying. I had the wrong numbers. I've been trying to contact different people.
Uh-huh.
And just to get on, I have my granddaughter. I put her in the swing and shut the door because I guess my daughter doesn't. She hasn't really recognized. It's like, you've been doing this forever. I can't believe you're doing it again. So she didn't see the urgency to get back for me to go to a meeting. And so I just prepared myself in another manner for this phone meeting. Yeah. And I'm glad I did.
We're glad that you're here, Sharon. We really are. You know?
And your name is again?
I'm Camilla. And our speaker is Craig.
Craig, yeah. Okay, and I want to thank you as well and for asking him to speak. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
We're glad you're here.
Thank you. And I'm going to keep coming.
Does somebody have their phone on speaker? We're getting it echoing, and that's usually because of the speaker.
Hang on, I have a statement, not a question, if I may.
Okay, come on, Brian.
Yeah, Brian Attic. And it's not for you, Craig. We're here to honor you, and I know that, since I'm a home group member here, I know that. But I wanted to share something with Sharon that you might maybe can expound on. I heard the word should a moment ago. I should recover different or something with a should in it, Sharon. And maybe, Craig, maybe this is the question. Craig, would you help her by sharing her it's not a should, but it's a could do something different? Should is such a demanding word where could takes all the pressure out of the statement.
That's right. Well, you exemplified it well. I like that. That's right. And that's keeping it to its simplest form. They say simplicity is the key.
Yeah. And I thank you for sharing with us tonight, Craig. I enjoyed hearing your ish.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Like I said, you know, it was only God working through Carmella and the time. And, I, you know, like I said, I'm home this week and, you know, taking care of, you know, my health. But I'll be back at Fort Drum on Monday. And, you know, she called me and it just gave me an opportunity to get back. And I just thought it was God working, man. And, you know, I feel better about myself that I was able to connect, you know, and keep my commitment.
We are very thankful to you for doing that. You know, you helped us out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe
you
tell
me
some of them West Philadelphians to about our website and a by phone.
I will. I'll definitely do that.
Especially the ones that you see that have an oxygen tube sticking in their nose or they're in a wheelchair, you know?
I know a couple of them like that. I have a good friend of mine, and part of his story, he can't get out and do many meetings. But he was one of my, if you remember, I was telling you about my predecessors in the game. Dave is, I'm 63, he's 72. And he's one of the ones that were, you know, he was sent to Lexington. He went to Lexington. He actually is on a breathing application right now. But his story, this is how, you know, we hear from, you know, when we talk about the obsession and compulsion, he was at Greater First State Penitentiary, and that's one of the most notorious penitentiaries in Pennsylvania. And part of his story, back in the 70s, you could actually get, they called them furloughs. you would go home for the weekend, right? They would let you go home for the weekend, but he could not furlough because he couldn't get clean in prison.
Wow.
Ain't that deep?
That is.
Yeah, so I'm going to give him the number. He would look. He doesn't make as many meetings. Dave has like 14 years, but he can't get to as many meetings. So I'm going to definitely tap him into that because, you know, he's suffering with, I think, a COPD pretty bad. But when I heard his story, when he talked about the fact that, you know, can you imagine the obsession and compulsion to use? You're in the penitentiary, and you can't get a clean urine to get home.
Wow. That's a horror story.
Right. Right. Yes, it is.
Well, there's almost 60 meetings a week by 17 different groups now on the phone lines.
Oh, good. Okay. Wow. So I'm going to go on the website, and I'm going to definitely – is 16 different meetings a week?
Almost 60.
60?
60. I think it's like 57 or 58 meetings a week by 17 different groups.
Oh, wow. On the same number?
Nope, they all have different numbers. That's why you have to go to the website.
Okay, all right.
But they're all listed there on the website.
Okay.
So great. Well, let's close this out then.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you so much, Craig, for sharing your unique insights with us.
Thank you.
Truly, truly been a pleasure having you with us, and you are so right. You know, God does always work to his own time schedule and his own methods, and it was just perfect that you were here with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
Okay.
Remember, friends, you can download all of our former speakers, make a Seventh Tradition donation, and get all the teleconference meeting schedules and other phone meeting information at Historical Significance website, nabyphone.com. That's nabyphone.com. Let's close with Just for Today. Tell yourself, just for today, my thoughts will be on my recovery, living and enjoying life without the use of drugs. Just for today, I will have faith in someone in NA who believes in me and wants to help me in my recovery. Just for today, I will have a program. I will try to follow it to the best of my ability. Just for today, through NA, I will try to get a better perspective on my life. Just for today, I will be unafraid. My thoughts will be on my new associations, people who are not using and who have found a new way of life. So long as I follow that way, I have nothing to fear. Just for today.